Ask away.
Okay. Well, it's Richard Mackey again with Graham Zilm and Carrie Lind. Is that how you?
Linda.
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 It's a Scandinavian E.
And so as I was saying beforehand, we've had we have heard about you from at least half a dozen people, and you've been connected with the 60s, with the late 60s, with student radicalism and alternative politics. But perhaps we could start with your background, where you're from, and then proceed into law school and your undergraduate years first.
Sure. I was born in New York City, and because you're going to be editing all this, I'll just say a whole bunch of stuff. In the 1960s in Vancouver at UBC, it was interesting because several of the so-called radical students were Americans originally. And also, many of the, I shouldn't say many, some of the key individuals on campus, and not just at UBC, were former American professors who had, I lived with one when I first got married, I boarded with one who came out of California, driven out of the California system during the McCarthy era, or the what was left over of the McCarthy era in the late 50s.
What was his name?
His name was Arthur Link. There was a series of people who, the head of the religious studies program, I think, was another one of them at the time. I can't remember who that was. But there were many people who came out of the Asia. My friend Arthur was a Chinese expert. And if you had any sympathy or any kind of interesting thing to say about China back in the 50s, so I'm told, you'd be blacklisted. Anyway, so I was brought up in New England, basically, Vermont, essentially. Went to school at a prep school in New Hampshire. My father and my mother's brother and her father were all Harvard guys. I could have gone into Harvard. It never occurred to me. I was, as a kid, I was fascinated with wildlife, Mother Nature, and determined that I wanted to, when I got out of school, I wanted to be a zoologist or field biologist or a big game hunter or something. My father was a fisherman and a hunter, and I did a lot of that. I was raised, you know, running around in the woods collecting skeletons of mice and putting them back together, taxidermy and all that shit. So at that time, which would be the late 50s, my high school years were 56 to 60, most of the big game was in Alaska, which at that time was on the far side of the moon from somebody on the East Coast. So British Columbia was just as good. So I remember once writing a letter when I was in my sophomore year to the University of British Columbia, Canada, and I got a response, and so here I am. And when I actually landed for the first time in Vancouver, it was a propeller-driven plane back in the fall of 1960. I got to the airport, and I remember looking out to see if I could see any polar bears. That's how ridiculous I was. So that old myth about American ignorance was true, alive and well. I went into, took general arts, zoology, lived in Acadia Camp, which I'll leave to you to research if you want to know what that was all about.
This was undergraduate?
Yes. So my freshman year was the fall of 60, and Acadia Camp. There was two camps, co-ed units. One was Fort Camp and Acadia Camp, and they were the old huts from the Army. I went into arts. In my second year, I roomed with a Caucasian friend who had been brought up in Trinidad. He was from Toronto, but his father was a doctor in Trinidad, and he came with an education and an understanding and a knowledge that was so far beyond anything I'd ever thought about. Here I was, basically interested in the phyla of the animal kingdom, And this guy came in here with history and religion and philosophy and art and psychology. Well, the short of it was, I completely blew my second year. I just found it so ridiculous what the school was trying to do with us. In my second year English exam, this friend of mine, John Hill, who's stayed true to his colors, one of the few people I know, he's been in Australia for decades now. We would spend our time basically sleeping all day, and because we lived in a basement, we could cut the ladder, and all night we'd be up and around doing things for months. So when my final English 200 exam came along, I spent the whole hour and a half or whatever it was, two or three of these blue books, simply describing what the professor was doing. So it was literally a stream of consciousness description of, you're leaning over Sally, you're picking your nose, you're sitting down, you seem to have gone to the bathroom. Did that straight. So I just sort of gave the middle finger to the whole system, failed a course, bounced out, much to my father's dismay. Was back east my father's 25th Harvard reunion, and which was a huge fete, an amazing event in Cambridge. I got chatting with I'd always been interested in drumming. I always had sticks in my hands. And I was chatting with a drummer of the then Glenn Miller band, minus Glenn Miller. And he mentioned that there was a jazz school in Boston called the Berklee School of Jazz, which is sort of the world school for jazz. And my father said, I'll give you one more chance. So I went in for summer school there. I'd had no musical experience, and I was 20. But I did all right in theory, so they took me in for the main first year, which was a three-year program. I had a wealthy aunt that gave me a Selmer tenor saxophone along the way. There was no way I was going to be you can't start at 20 with no musical instrument background and suddenly think you're going to become a jazz musician. Let's talk about ridiculous. But my mother, again, much to her later chagrin, sent me an article from Time magazine in 1963, which described that there was two Harvard professors who had been gotten in serious trouble with Harvard, and for the first time in the history of Harvard, one of them, a tenured professor, was fired, and they were involved in research on drugs and the mind. Well, there I was, just across the Charles River from Cambridge, and I scooted over there, and I ended up spending about 2 months on a daily basis working sort of as an office boy for Tim Leary and Dick Alpert. Dick Alpert went on to become Ram Dass and is still alive and publishing and everything. Tim Leary, of course, went on to do his thing. But at that time, when I met them, they were still quasi-Harvard-related, jacket and tie, pushing psilocybin, which was the drug out of the mushrooms out of Mexico, plus LSD as, turn on, tune in, and drop out. Their theory, and they had a lot of push behind it, was that if you could just get all of the politicians and leading people to drop acid, there'd be peace in the world. And it's interesting to think about that anybody would take that seriously now, but it was very serious back in 63, 64. And I had an incredible fortune to sort of sit around and listen to the likes of Aldous Huxley was still alive, Watts and Califf Alan Watts and Sausalito. Anyway, that gave me an enormous education on the history of psychotropic drugs in the native groups and religions in the Western Hemisphere, essentially. And that is still a subject of fascination to everybody. Recently, the whole thing about ayahuasca from Peru and South America and all of that. So I remember spending a lot of time at the Botanical Library at Harvard, where there was a very famous botanist who had classified a whole bunch of stuff. And it turned out that except for the opium plant and marijuana, all of the other major, and there's dozens of them, psychotropic drugs come from plants in the Amazon basin. And I'm sure that there's some we haven't discovered. So it was a scholastic enterprise of the first order. I had never had any experience even in smoking marijuana, although I did start smoking dope at that time. I don't have any objection, by the way, to you printing any of this about what my drug use. I think it's been it's ridiculous that people think they shouldn't tell anybody that they've ever smoked dope. But the short of that was that my roommate from my second year, John Hill, was out here. He was a poet. And I didn't discover, but it was known, and I sent out here, that if you ate enough morning glory seeds, you get stoned. So there was some fun stuff around that. I got very interested in psychology and decided I wanted to get back into university. The second year that I missed school, I stopped the music school. I ski-bummed, and I decided I wanted to go into Mexico to get into the mountains of Oaxaca to experience for my first time the magic mushrooms. That didn't work. But in the meantime, I reapplied to UBC. UBC had come, the Senate had come to the idea that just because a student fails out doesn't mean he's a bad person, and maybe we should let him back in. So as soon as I heard that, I volunteered, and I got back in. They took me back. So I came back to repeat my second year in psychology in 1963, fall of 63. And for a reason that this is all, I don't know how much this makes sense to you with why I'm saying it, but it explains a lot of what people's attitudes were when I got, by the time I got to law school, what I've been through and why I thought the way I did. To make a long story short, when I got back, I made some inquiries around it. I discovered that somebody, a scientist on the campus, was what they call a microphile, someone who liked mushrooms. And he would go around and would sample all kinds of mushrooms for food purposes. And it turned out that I heard from a friend of his who stayed in the Acadia camp that one night, after a glass of wine and a steak and a couple of mushrooms, he was in the bathtub and he felt kind of, something just a little different. Something just, nothing major, nothing he would have told anybody about. But I sort of jumped at it. It's going to be the magic mushrooms. And so, which at that time were not known to exist north of Mexico, period. No history. Because certainly if they had, if you look at the peyote in the Native American church out of the Southwest, the mescaline, which is the drug, the very beautiful drug that's in peyote, has caused the American Indians down in the Southwest to create a religion and an art form and a culture around that chemical. And that happens as well in South America. Had there been any mushrooms north of up in this country, they'd be on totem poles, they'd be all over the place, for sure. Anyway, so he explained these different mushrooms, and he knew a bit about the history, and we estimated what it would take. I went out and I took some of these mushrooms that he said he'd found in a sufficient volume, a lot more than he did. Waited around, nothing happened. Went back. I love telling this story because I relive it. Went back the next day. It's not quite the same. If you look at the gills underneath the cap and the stipe, it's a different color. So I went back out, and this was in the Aggie fields behind UBC, which is now the hockey arena. That used to be a cow pasture, that whole area out there. And so I went back out, found what I thought I had, went up to Acadia camp, ate my dinner, then took the mushrooms. Waited around for 20, 30 minutes, nothing happened, gave up, forgot about it. Well, about an hour and a half, 2 hours later, holy shit, I didn't realize how stoned I was. I was walking back home and walking back to where I lived in this guy's basement on Westbrook Crescent. Which at the time I lived in the closest house to the law school, where the gauge towers are was just a big field with radio antennas, and there was a path that went right through there to Westbrook Crescent. The Westbrook Mall wasn't there, that avenue there, and it was in the basement of a house. And I'm going back there with the boy who lived there, my husband. All of a sudden, my sleeve got caught on a rose bush, like doing this red rose was going like this. I mean, it was Wow. So anyway, so that I sort of say is sort of the official discovery of the mushroom. Now, I since sent a lot of I sent them off to a mycologist in University of Michigan named Smith, and the psilocybin was found in it. I eventually went back with it to Millbrook, New York, where Tim Leary, this was a couple of years after I met him, was now living in a big mansion and into all kinds of stuff with famous people and musicians and, you know, Persian carpets on the roof and everywhere, just doing into the drug thing really big. Swapped some of that for pure Sandoz pharmaceutical LSD, came back to Vancouver with the only time I've ever had pure pharmaceutical LSD that you could measure with a hypo and was in it. And that was my first example with LSD, although I had the mushrooms many, many times. Went into a Buddhist 400 class. This was in my second year. Or was I in third year? And the teacher was this man, Arthur Link, who had come out of China and had LSD experience. And that opened up an awful lot of things, and it changed my life. It changed my attitude. There are frequent times when I sit around, just one of the fellows here, with lawyers I know and other people, and we say, you know, everybody's had some experience with some of these drugs. What did they change? How would your life have been if it hadn't happened? Well, nobody knows how it would have been, but everybody says it was a profound change, or not a change, development, the developmental input. So I come into law school with that free expression. The world is wide open. There's so much out there which has been hidden, falling upon sort of the repressive 50s. Mario Savio at the free speech movement in Berkeley a few years earlier had opened up the whole idea that students could stand up and say, fuck the system. We want this. We demand this. The war in Vietnam had been picked up and was outrageous, and there was a growing fight against that in the not just students. There was people in there was Rudi Dutschke in Germany, Danny, there was a guy named somebody the Red in France. Germany and France were, particularly in France in 68, was almost on the verge of a revolution. It was a riot as opposed to a revolution, because they had the workers and the teachers. In France, was De Gaulle was really in panic. There was the, forget the names, there was a movement in Japan. Canada was kind of, you know, politely modest as we are, except for some of us. So in 1968-69, there was, the students were really having things happen on a daily basis, particularly on campus. The activity was unbelievable. I never studied in law school. I don't mind if you say that. I never studied. I remember spending 5 minutes ever studying, except near the end for an exam. But I never missed a class. I went to every single class and paid close attention. At the end of the I'll have to keep some names private here, but at the end of my third year, I remember going to one of my close friends, can I borrow your notes? That's what I guess I did that each year. I get the best. And one of the guys who finally let me look at his notes made me promise never to show it to another one of our classmates, because both of them were in competition for whatever the top award is, or the governor award or something. My guy got it, as it turned out. but there, every day, I would spend every class, and I never went to the library. I don't remember I went in the library more than 5 times in my life, because there was so much happening on the campus. If you pull the UBC, go to the library and pull out the front volume, the UBC came out 3 times a week, and every issue was controversial. Every issue was talking about some guy from somewhere coming to speak someplace, or 3 or 4 of them at once, on amazing stuff. Whether it was as ridiculous as the man who thought you had to have clothes on chickens, to a Black Panther person, or something, this and this and that. And I was writing for the UBC at the same time. I In 1968, let me back up, the student government, the alma mater side, the AMS, had traditionally been a bastion of reactionary individuals, and the president of the student body had always been the president of the Young Liberals Club, who always was a lawyer. The law school had a lock historically on the president of the AMS, and they did nothing. The student union building was being built in 66, 67, I forget the years, but it opened officially the year that I became the AMS vice president. For the first time, in so that would be, I think, in the spring of, the AMS elections are in the spring of the year, I think, for the following year, right? You've been there. If they still have them, they're still in AMS?
They're still in AMS, yeah.
There was the arts, the first student group that became progressive was the Arts Undergraduate Society with Stan Persky, who's gone on, I don't know if he's retired. He was an American, he's a teacher over at the college across the way over North Vancouver, what is that, Cap College? Mm-hmm. There was a whole bunch of very interesting individuals, and it wasn't hard to, because no one ever campaigned, so they had a sort of a slate, and I helped them, but I was in first year law, so suddenly there was an Arts Undergraduate Society who put on the student council a progressive radical student as the Arts AMS rep. That was kind of the first inroad, and that caused real chaos among the reaction, the engineers, you know, the Aggies, everybody else that had sort of run that thing as a unique little club that didn't want to get involved in anything. I helped them run off an arts anti-calendar. It was the first anti-calendar in Canada. And that was my memory of staying up late, because it was thick, and it was Gestetner, and it was interviews, questionnaires went to all students, and they were ranking the classes and the professors. I did the same thing when I got into law school, and I got threatened. Threatened is not the word. I got told by somebody who went on to become a very prominent lawyer in Vancouver. He was a third year student. I was in my second year. And that I would forever destroy the reputation of the law school. And how dare I sully his degree. And also, at one point, there was a, when I was I, when I in my third year, when I was the president of law students, I was at a conference in Guelph, at Queens. There's a lawyer in Vancouver whose name will come in a minute, who was the head of the law school there, and there was a big conference with judges and attorneys generals and professors and students, and I forget what the topic was, but it was the first big kind of gathering of the profession. There was a professor there named Morley. He's still around. Anyway, I did some interesting things there, apparently. My memory is very bad, but I'm told that when I was at a dinner one night, I just sort of stood up to everybody hold hands with the person next to you. I mean, the hippie thing was still much in there. Mm-hmm. But I remember saying, I do remember this, and it's sort of, I've enjoyed the fact that people remember. I was on a panel, and I said something about, what was that expression? There's that expression, somebody doesn't know something from their asshole or something. Mm-hmm.
Well, there's the hawk from a handsaw, and then it probably gets.
I said something about the law profession does know its asshole because it's always looking in the mirror backwards. Better than that, but something like that. Anyway, when I got back from that, I criticized the UBC because we had no, I don't think we had more than one, first, second, and third year were all the same. There was no choices in until third year, maybe one in second, two in third year. no choices. It's ridiculous. And I was very critical. I came back, and one of the professors, and I'm not so sure, I'll leave it to you, Leon Getz, you can decide whether you want to use names, took me aside and was, again, was really pissed at me, very pissed off that I was out there saying negative things about UBC Law School. And again, out of context, after I became president, I went to the Alumni Association and I got $500 to publish a brief, which I then took 500 copies of some up to Prince George to the 1969 meeting of the British Columbia, or the Law Society's annual meeting, I think. And in the 1967, 68, 69, there was a free press out of Los Angeles called the LA Free Press. And there was a man named Cobb, C-O-B-B-E, who wrote the most cutting, brilliant cartoons. So every week this would come out with an incredible cartoon, just lampooning and pulverizing capitalism and the establishment. And I put a few of those in this thing. And what I was, I talked about how Harvard had student participation in legal aid, and how Harvard had lots of choices you could make in second year, even first year. And I said, our law school is so far behind in this thing. The law school has a copy of that, and I have one somewhere. But I got quite a lot of praise from John Ferris and some of the older people up there who you would have thought would have given me hell for showing up and criticizing the profession. And they were so delighted because about a year later, well, no, during my attempt to become a lawyer, when I was being grilled for a couple days by the benchers, one of those guys was a witness and said that the students had never joined the BC Bar Association, for instance, but there was a large increase in student participation, and he credited all back to that, me doing this and that. So that was kind of fun. So there was a lot of shit going on in all directions, but to go back, so...
Can I just...
Yep.
Jump in and just ask what, just to get a kind of benchmark, when did you, what did you get your BA, what was your undergraduate degree?
My BA, I got my BA in 67 from UBC in psychology. Or it was, it might have been psychology and religious studies. I had determined that psychology was vacuous, you know. When I came back, having not had a drug experience at the time, but read about it, studied it, learned all about the religious experience and all that kind of stuff, when I came back to UBC to get back in, the first place I went to was the religious studies faculty, and they said, there's nothing here of that which you're interested in. The artists, I went to psychology. Everybody bounced me around. Nobody wanted to look at the question of what is it in the human mind that has been cloistered in our industrialized post-capitalist society that has shut out the connection with the divine and nature that still exists in the so-called quote-unquote primitive societies. And what is it about the drug experience that brings this apparently out? And what is it about the drug experience that causes people to equate that with meditative experiences in the Eastern religions?
I was
just shunned. Yeah. You know,
those are pretty advanced questions for a traditional religious studies program.
Yeah. Now, Arthur Link, having taken LSD as a middle-aged older man, just before I'd like he was in, and after being a PhD, and I mean he was in China on a Fulbright scholarship in 48-49 and witnessed the revolution. He came out of China with a lot of beautiful stuff. His house was phenomenal. These sort of guys would never ever had even heard the phrase let's drop acid for the fun of it. I remember the first time I ever heard that, and the first person ever told me that they were going to take mushrooms or LSD just for a kick, I was very, very angry. You don't do that. of course, I went on to do it many, many times. It's a great, I certainly urge anybody to do it. So I went from arts, first year law, I helped with the arts undergraduate calendar. I came into UBC, we did one of those, we did the FLEA, and then the arts people decided we're going to run a slate for the AMS. And Stan Persky ran for president, and I ran for vice president, and we all got in. Totally freaked out the reactionaries. The law students, there was a student court, the law students got together and decided that Stan Persky did, because he'd come up from California, he was missing this and that, he was disqualified for some technical reason. I became interim president for a long time while Dave Zern, a liberal, Dave Zernhelt, who went on to become an NDP MLA out of Williams Lake area, became president after a while. I went back to vice president. That whole thing was ridiculous. I kind of quit that. In the middle of all that, though, 1968 comes along. The Democratic Convention was in late summer, Chicago. I was there. I went there because there was going to be the Canadian Union of Students, CUS, was organizing around progressive issues, and there was going to be an annual meeting. During this time, Simon Fraser became a very significant physical fact, because when the student union building at UBC opened up, there was nowhere, and we all were paranoid conspiracy theorists, figured that was done on purpose, there was nowhere where you could put more than 10 people together, other than outside, whereas the quad at Simon Fraser was a covered area that was built by Arthur Erickson, where we could have great student demonstrations, microphones and this and that. And so Martin Loney, who was the president of Simon Fraser, an Englishman, a brilliant guy, very progressive, extremely progressive. Others, there was lots of stuff going on at Simon Fraser. And one of the quick things that happened at Simon Fraser was that people started saying, who the hell is Simon Fraser? Well, Simon Fraser was the worst sort of person who would ever want to name anything after, as it turned out, Very, very mean and anti-religious, and absolute, on the Indians, a Hudson's Bay type rip-off artist, the worst sort of thing. So suddenly everybody wanted to change it to the name Louis Riel. Now, Louis Riel was a good person, and you should have seen the Vancouver press. Because there would be a meeting and a demonstration and a vote to change the name, you'd think that the students had picked up bazookas and were about to destroy the place physically. What are the students, and that became a really interesting subject. And the Métis from the prairies really loved it. Letters and people coming out and dances. It was great stuff. It was such fun. I mean, it was serious stuff, but it was such fun. And then there was a sit-in up there. I remember going down to Burnaby, had a brand new jail, police station, and they busted a whole bunch of students, UBC students, Simon Fraser students, for sitting in the faculty, the administration building up there. I remember going down there as a law student to speak to them, hearing them sing, I Will Overcome. Now, there was a great demo at UBC. I went to Chicago, was there for about a week leading up to the whole thing. I fled Chicago the night before the convention, because I found myself, like so many others, looking for a brick to throw at a cop, because the police were coming by on horses with their truncheons and just bashing people, knocking people silly for nothing other than just being standing there objecting. And I wasn't so much in my mind of getting rough. I didn't want to have to come back from UBC to stand trial. So I took off to Guelph, where we had the student union, the CUS meeting, was just about to start. They were totally synchronous. And then another thing that was kind of funny, there was a, I forget whether it was there or in Winnipeg, but I went to the, we were in a dorm. We had our rooms in the dorm, and we were eating in the dorm, students from all over Canada. And there was a bulletin board, and I remember writing a note, and I put it in the book, because Stokely Carmichael was the head of an American organization called SNCC, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. He went on to become a congressman or governor or something, I forget. I remember putting a little note, because we were into this big time. I put a note saying, the Student Violent Coordinating Committee, will meet at, and I put a fictitious room up there, at 8:30 tonight. Because we knew that the cops had planted people with us. We had no doubt whatsoever that there were undercover students working for the police. And the funny thing is, 4 years later, 3 years later, when I was before the benchers to become an Arlington student, one of the questions that came from the lawyer for the benchers, who had the entire, had my FBI file, which I'm sad to say had nothing in it. There was a report, the FBI had not, but the Canadian police file had a lot of stuff on everybody. And I was asked the question, if I knew anything about a meeting in that dorm for an organization called the Student, I laughed, and they said, what's so funny about that? I told them the story, you know. Just, so that's going on. In spring of 1969, I'm approached by Jerry Parody, who went on to become a provincial court judge in North Vancouver. He may still be there. I hope not. He's older than me. He should have retired. He was a third-year student. He says, Kerry, we want you to run for president of the law students. I said, why? Well, if nobody runs, I mean, it's a one-noon-hour fun event. We meet in the library. People throw you know, their lunch bags and muffins at people, and you make a silly speech, and so-and-so is going to run. I forget who it was. I think he was the other guy who was going to be the Governor General Award winner. He's going to be the president of law students, but we don't want it to go by default. We might have some fun with this. Will you do it? Will you do it? You know, and some other third-year student said, yeah, do it. You know, because they were waiting for the... So I said, okay. So unbeknownst to them, I decided to do this very seriously on the one hand. So because I had access to Gestetners and nobody else did, and particularly silk screening, I just threw a whole bunch of stuff out, actually, just this last couple months ago. I kept all this. I went and ran on my student number. I had I put up a thing all over the place that I wanted. My goal as president of the law students was to integrate the faculty washrooms. And I did have my name in certain places, and I made a run of it, and we plastered the place with all this shit. And then all of a sudden, Ian Maxwell, who's still practicing, my classmate, he decides he's going to run. Mm-hmm. Two or three or four people decide to run, and it was a contest. And those guys were serious, and I wasn't. Mm-hmm. The last thing I wanted was to be president of this reactionary bunch. Are you kidding? But the rumor is that the third year class got together to give me as a gift to the dean, and they voted me. I won. So here I am, president of law students. Well, one of the things I did, there was a student, a guy who didn't go on to do law, and Charlie Cooks was in a class. He was an artist. He had access to art. We took all, in the old student common room, was just full of couches, a cigarette machine or something, and then all the class pictures of all the classes since 49, we took all that shit down, put it in the basement, and we had every couple of months we'd have a different art show. You know, and we just really got things going. But my first order of business was, I remember when I got accepted to law school, I got a letter from the outgoing president of the law students that says that you've made it, you're one of the privileged. It did not those words, but you know, come to the law school and, you know, look well. I don't think it told me I had to have that suit and tie, but anyway. So when I became president, I sent this law school did it. I sent a letter off to all the incoming first-year students and said, hey, listen, just because you're coming into law school, don't swell on your head. And whatever you wear normally, don't change the way you dress coming here, da-da-da-da-da-da. Then here's a name you want to find out. His name was Nowatzki. Twills, Wills? You can find him. Opening day. First day of law school, 1970, everybody's looking pretty normal. Up comes this long-haired, hippie-looking guy, barefoot. He went on to become the president of law school 3 years later. Nowatzki, Till, I think it was Till, something like that. And he looked up and he said, "Hey, did you send me this letter?" "Yeah, cool, man, thanks." So we did a couple things. I made that presentation to the Canadian Bar and the law school, and Trudeau appointed a future Supreme Court judge called Gerald Ledeen to do a royal commission on the non-medical use of drugs, which went around the country. And here it is.
It was the Ledeen Commission.
The Ledeen Commission. Yeah, I remember that. And I decided it would be fun to see how many law students smoke dope. So I went to Dean Curtis. Now, let me break and talk about George Curtis. The basement a suite I had in a house on Westbrook Crescent, it was a direct straight line across the street, bang, right into the law school, past the law school to Buchanan Building. I went by the law school twice, three, four times a day for years. And because I had lawyers in my background, when I got my BA, I had no idea what I was going to do. I had no idea. So I'm going back to home one day after my last class, and I was sitting and said, maybe it'd be fun to know the law. Just so I turned left, went to the law school, right then and there signed up, and within a week they told me I was in. No LSATs or whatever they are, just boom, bang, boom. I had no idea until the day I actually decided to turn. It wasn't something I'd been thinking about all through high school. When did you decide you wanted to be a lawyer?
When I was about 28.
Yeah. Well, that's pretty late. I was about the same age. So George Curtis lived the next block up, and I had a dog named Friar, a black lab, infamous in the law school. Infamous.
We've heard stories.
Because all the law students would stick, there was places you hang your coats, they'd put their lunch bag under their coat and their shoes or boots, and you'd see Friar way across campus with a brown bag and, you know, so they started putting him up. So George and I chit-chat, he knew Friar. So there was a building there, it was called the Big Black Hut. It was a war building, and it's like an amphitheater. There was a stage with tar paper around the outside, uglier than hell, rough seats, but they went up to the back. And George taught contracts. And he, because he was dean, was late quite frequently. And one day, we were waiting for him, and Friar is running around. So I take Friar, he's very well trained. I stand him at the lectern up on the front, and I put his feet up in the lectern, and I say, "Hold." So everybody, all my buddies, "Oh, you're in trouble now. You're going to get it now," you know. And eventually, George comes in, and unbeknownst to everybody else, you know, he knows his dog better than almost everybody. And so as soon as the Friar sees George, tail wagging, George, just a hug, a nice comment. The only comment he makes is that during the war, he was in the First World War. If you didn't have a dog as a mascot, you were in trouble. That was the only thing. And he was great. So I get this idea. So I go and I see him. I say, "Listen, I want to do a survey of the law students on marijuana use." He said, I don't know exactly who said what next, but within a flash, it was agreed that he would write a letter on his letterhead as dean to all the law students, urging them to honestly and completely answer the questions on the reverse side. So I did that, and you can go to the commission report, and you can pull this out of Exhibit E. And it says that the BC Vancouver sample of 434, 44.5%, at least within the last 6 months, of 45% of law students had smoked dope back in 1967. So the odds are that, and I hope you'll quote me on this, although I wouldn't be surprised if you don't. The odds are that was how many years ago? 30 years ago, the percentage of judges, prosecutors, senior lawyers, and lawyers today who have smoked dope or still do smoke on a regular basis would be up in the 80s, I would imagine. I mean, the hypocrisy that we have in this country, particularly in the legal profession, around drug use. Another thing which annoys me is the total silence of the legal profession on how Uncle Sam came in here and kidnapped Mark Emery out of Canada on the bogus idea that he had sold some seeds, and the Canadian government permitted the extradition of this man, and you didn't hear a word from a lawyer. Just, it was just disgraceful. I'll get you a copy of this.
Thank you.
I don't imagine you'd print it without having to see it.